Stacey Vanek Smith.
Cardiff Garcia.
We host Planet Money's other podcast?
The Daily Podcast. We're not other.
Yeah, the Daily Podcast.
We are us.
The Indicator.
The Indicator.
Stop othering us. And we just got back from a week in California.
Yes, we did.
And while we were there, one day I trekked up a hill in Los Angeles with NPR business reporter and LA resident Sonari Glinton. Sonari, where are we?
We're at the Baldwin Hills Overlook, which is, you have likely seen this in a commercial. We're sort of in the middle of the LA Basin, and it gives us this incredible view. So as you can look almost 360 and see all away around the Los Angeles Basin.
This is what the literary types would call a sweeping vista, I think. Where are the movie lots?
Well, one of the movie lots we're like very nearby. That right there is Culver Studios. That's where Mel Brooks has his office. It's where they filmed Gone with the Wind. Sony is over there, and Century City obscures 20th Century Fox or 21st Century Fox, the movie studio. And the other movie studios we can't see because they're in the valley, and Paramount is somewhere in Hollywood.
Okay, and we've got you out here because when people think of LA, they think of some fairly obvious industries, right? Film, entertainment, Hollywood. There's more to it than that.
Yeah, do you think that 18 million people moved here because of Hollywood?
That's a lot of people with dreams of stardom.
Yeah, that ain't what it's about. I mean, Hollywood is very important, clearly, but that's just one of the baubles in a drawer full of industries.
Hello and welcome to Planet Money. I'm Cardiff Garcia.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. And we are the hosts of The Indicator from Planet Money. Now, California is just a huge, formidable economy. It's one of the largest economies in the country. It's actually also one of the biggest economies in the world. California's economy, Cardiff, is bigger than France's economy.
Ooh, take that.
C'est pas possible.
France.
C'est pas possible.
So today on the show, The Indicator goes to California. We see what we can learn from this powerhouse economy. We started a celery farm facing a labor drought. We head to a metro station at the heart of the state's housing crisis. And we end up in one of the country's biggest ports.
You may or may not hear a ship horn.
You definitely will.
You'll definitely hear a ship horn. Stay with us.
Support for Planet Money and the following message come from Wonder Capital. What if you could help businesses across the U.S. go solar while earning up to 7.5% annually? Since 2015, individuals have invested tens of millions of dollars using Wonder Capital's solar investment platform. These individuals have helped to finance nearly 200 large-scale solar energy projects across the U.S. Get started at wondercapital.com/money. Wonder Capital, where impact investing meets capitalism.
Hey, I'm Kelly McEvers from Embedded. Bill Spencer works at a coal mine in Kentucky. And when I start to ask him about a future without coal, he knows what I'm going to say.
So if
coal goes out, I'm done for.
Coal Stories on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Dollar for dollar, California is the biggest agricultural economy in the country. Almonds, oranges, avocados, spinach, berries, they're all big business out here.
But that business is having big trouble. Each year, it's been tougher and tougher for farmers to find workers to harvest all their crops.
It smells like celery out here.
Yeah, no, you definitely get the, it's kind of nice where we are today because we're really close to the ocean. So you get a combination of that sea air and a little bit of celery hint. So pretty nice spot to be.
That pretty nice spot to be is a celery field in Ventura County, California. We were there with Tom Deardorff. His family has owned farms in that area for about 80 years.
It's like an ocean of celery.
Yeah, no, there's probably 80 acres of celery here in the field that we're at right now.
Really?
So that will all get harvested in about 2.5 weeks.
In the middle of the ocean of celery, there is a crew of about 30 workers. They walk in a row in big straw hats, hacking off celery stalks and tossing them onto this motorized platform, which stretches across the field and chugs along behind them. They're so fast. It's really cool.
They are. It's a skilled position that takes a lot of years of experience to be able to perform at this level, and obviously you can see they've mastered it.
On that moving platform, another worker cleans up the celery stalk and then packs it into a box. Alex Martinez is the harvest manager out here, and he shows us his celery blade.
It's a 12-inch Dexter stainless steel machete that is then
cut about 4 inches from the top, turned and re-welded back to it.
Oh, this is like a custom job.
So, yes.
A lot of crops can be harvested by machine. Crops like wheat, corn, potatoes. But most fruits and vegetables aren't quite uniform enough to be harvested like that. For the most part, they have to be harvested by hand.
It is really hard and dangerous work. 10-hour days swinging a knife in the hot sun. And when the job market's strong, like it has been for the last few years, these workers have a lot of other options.
They move into whether it's landscaping jobs, construction jobs, food service jobs, whenever there's an increase in demand from the general economy. Workers generally migrate away from farm work into other areas.
So Tom Deardorff has had to compete for workers. He's raised their pay by actually quite a lot. Back in 2006, working the celery field paid about $8.70 an hour. Now it pays more than $21 an hour. So pay has gone up by more than double. And that is way faster than wages have grown in most of the country. Now, we are well aware of the criticism that's been around for a while that the agriculture sector relies on underpriced labor, and in particular on undocumented workers who take very little money for backbreaking work. We couldn't speak to any of the workers on Tom's farm, but Tom says his workers all are documented and that even doubling wages hasn't solved the labor problem.
Yeah, I don't think it's an economic issue. I think it's a political issue. I mean, it is not sustainable under the current political environment. That is true, because we do not have a legitimate immigration policy that allows us access to workers.
Tom says the agriculture visas that the country offers are not realistic for his business. They're too difficult to get, they're expensive, and there just aren't enough of them. Deardorff Farms used to hire more than 600 workers every year, but Tom says he can't make that happen anymore, so he's had to make changes to his business. For example, he's changed the crops that he plants.
We've shifted away from the most labor-intensive crops, so things like vine-ripe tomatoes we no longer grow anymore.
You don't grow them at all because of labor?
Correct. Yeah, there's just that program alone took about 400 workers. And so we just got to the point where we could no longer find a steady supply of labor and decided that we just needed to get out of that business altogether.
Deardorff Farms also got out of strawberries. Instead, Tom has gotten into leafy greens, things like kale, cilantro, broccoli, and celery. They require fewer workers and can be at least partly automated. Where Tom used to hire about 600 people every year, now he hires around 200. But even finding 200 workers has been hard. So Tom made another change.
We've also shifted a large amount of our production down into Mexico. So
you shifted production of a big chunk of what you do away from the United States, and now it's being made in Mexico because you couldn't find workers.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, basically, the fact of the matter is that a foreign-born person is going to be harvesting your fruits and vegetables. So the decision is, do we want to do that within the United States with a guest worker program, or do we want to have that foreign-born worker stay in his country and harvest your fruits and vegetables? So based on what we've seen in the political environment over the last 15 and 20 years, we have decided to go down there into Mexico.
How hard was it to make these kinds of decisions based on like what you were seeing?
I mean, if I was looking at spreadsheets all day long, it was a really simple decision and one we probably should have made 5 years before we made it. But I mean, these are ranches that my great-grandfather farmed and we'd rather keep them active, but the economics and the politics of it are suggesting that we do otherwise, so.
So Tom keeps doing what he can to attract workers, including using that little motorized platform, because it means that the workers don't have to carry these giant boxes of celery across the field.
So this machine is like kind of one of the ways that you attract the best people?
Definitely, yeah. No, you're looking for a competitive advantage in the labor market, and this is one way to do that, to provide a work environment that is safer, it's more efficient, and it's just slightly easier than what may occur in somebody else's field.
Do you worry that one year you're just not going to be able to produce whatever it is that you're aiming to produce because enough people just don't show up?
Yeah, we try and forecast that a little bit, and we reduce planting sizes, and we spread things out a little bit, and readjust based on what we feel the labor availability is going to be. And then we're constantly looking for innovation to get us the same production with less people. So we kind of attack it on two fronts.
Tom says his business has become this constant calculation of how to harvest more with less, how to get more crops out of the ground with fewer hands. Because in spite of everything, the harvesting machine, the higher pay, the different crops, his turnover rate keeps growing. Fewer and fewer of the same workers come back to his farms every year.
While we were in California, there was one very big piece of news. State legislators killed a bill called Senate Bill 827, or just SB 827.
Yes, SB 827 was meant to address the housing shortage in California. It's a shortage that has led to sky-high home prices. Of course, that is not just a California issue. It's a problem that California shares with a lot of places in the U.S.
And to talk about California's housing problems and to discuss why bills like SB 827 in particular struggle to get passed, we called Paavo Monkkonen. He's a professor of public policy and urban planning at UCLA. And he said, you know what? Meet me at this one particular metro station and I'll show you what this is all about.
Please stand back from the platform edge.
We're standing at the Westwood Rancho Park Expo Station, one of the stations in the city of LA's new transit infrastructure.
Why did you choose to have us meet you at this metro station?
Yeah, I think this is a good example of what's wrong with planning in California. So we've had this massive public investment in a metro system surrounded by single-family homes, as far as the eye can see. Most of them are one-story, 1950s stock.
This train station, surrounded by all these 1950s one-story houses, is new. And it looks like not that many local residents are using it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very skeptical that they do, but even if they did, you know, maximum 150 people from this neighborhood would be commuting to downtown.
Los Angeles is known for its sprawl. People who drive cars, living in flat single-family houses as far as the eye can see. And near this train station, there are no visible apartment complexes.
Paavo says that's too bad. Local zoning laws don't allow for certain kinds of buildings, like apartment complexes in certain areas, and that limits the overall housing supply. And that means fewer people using public transit stops like this train station, and also it means that house prices stay high, and so does the rent.
If you look at zoning in Los Angeles, 75% of residential land is zoned exclusively for low-density single-family homes. Those low-density single-family homes, on average, are 20% more expensive than houses in multifamily buildings. So I think that a logical housing policy would be to legalize the less expensive kind of housing if, in fact, we want to make housing more affordable.
And Los Angeles can't do that. Why?
Political opposition to change.
Remember that housing reform bill, SB 827? It was defeated literally the day before I met Paavo at that metro station.
Literally?
Literally. Not like the way the kids use literally,
but
where
actually,
it means figuratively, but actually.
In
right,
fact.
Right.
And this bill would have literally allowed more construction of apartment buildings close to busy public transit stops, like bus stops and train stations. And the idea was that building more apartments would mean more options for where people could live. And that would mean cheaper rent.
And it was kind of amusing to see how many politicians liked what the bill was trying to do, but ended up opposing the bill itself.
I do think we have a housing crisis in this state, but we also have to get it right. And I'm unfortunately not going to be supporting the bill today.
It pains me a bit to have to refrain from supporting the measure today.
So,
and I mean that.
I will continue to work with your bill if it doesn't get out of this committee today. And hopefully be able to support it. I have to see what the fashion.
And the reason SB 827 was so controversial is that it would have overruled the zoning laws that were already put in place by cities and towns throughout California. The laws determining where new construction is allowed, what kind of buildings are allowed, apartments versus houses, how many stories high the buildings can be. Paavo Monkkonen says there's a few reasons that neighborhoods, like the one surrounding the train station where we met him, don't often allow new building. One reason is that new building can go against the financial interest of homeowners.
In the U.S., we've devolved land use controls to local governments, and often they respond very much to neighborhood associations' interests. So I think there are a lot of reasons that people oppose new housing near them, but one of the main ones that's been out there in the literature for a long time is thinking about single-family homeowners as a kind of cartel, where they get together and collude to prevent new supply in order that their assets increase in value.
That's interesting because nobody really thinks of homeowners as a cartel. They're thought of as like living the American dream.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and that's a problem with the way we think about housing in the United States, right? So we want housing to be affordable on the one hand, but if we own a house, we might be happy when that house increases in value, right? And so I think people often in their own minds don't realize what's happening
A second reason people oppose more building in their neighborhoods is that they could simply be afraid of having their lives disrupted by the physical changes, by the construction.
People think that the city might come in and bulldoze their house and put up a public housing unit, when in fact what would happen is as people sell their houses from year to year, some people that want a single family house might buy that and keep it the same. In some cases, a developer might buy it and tear it down and build a four-story building or something. There are neighborhoods like this in LA, and people like them. They're not unpopular neighborhoods, so I don't think that people kind of understand how the change would affect the quality of life, and I think it would be probably minimal.
More legitimately, Pavo says, a third reason is that people worry that there will be more traffic, more congestion in their neighborhoods. Though, of course, that worry is somewhat addressed if the building takes place near public transit. And also, some neighborhood in the city is going to have to accept the traffic. Pavo's point is that the traffic would be more evenly distributed throughout the city if more building were allowed in the wealthier neighborhoods.
A fourth reason that some communities have opposed more building is that they just don't like developers.
Not at all.
We have a recent paper where we look at an experiment where we give people different reasons to oppose housing development, and we found that the one that elicits the most opposition to a hypothetical project is when we say that the developer is going to make a lot of money. So this is the one reason that actually doesn't affect people's neighborhood, but there's kind of this fairness, repugnant idea where
like
developers...
think they're getting ripped off or something?
I think it's connected to people seeing housing as kind of an important necessity for human life and then disliking people that profit off that. When often they themselves are profiting off the fact that there's a scarce supply of housing. So, you know, people are complicated and often hold contradictory opinions.
And finally, one of the effects of preventing new building, Pavo says, is that it can keep a city segregated by wealth and, in some cases, by race and ethnicity. People who live in apartments and pay rent, on average, make less money than people who own homes. But those apartments are not getting built in areas with a lot of single-family homes. So a final reason, also the ugliest reason, is that some communities want to exclude categories of people from living in their neighborhood.
Now, there's no simple solution to the conflict between communities that feel they have the right to decide for themselves what their neighborhood should look like and the need for more housing supply. But Pavo said, when housing costs remain unaffordable, it doesn't just hurt people who were forced to leave a thriving area because they couldn't afford rent or people who couldn't afford to live there in the first place. It also affects future generations. Pavo cites a paper from economist Raj Chetty.
And he finds that kind of some of the counties where it's best, you know, for your life's prospects to be born to a low-income family are in the Bay Area or in LA. And so by preventing low-income households from living here, we're denying their children a chance kind of at a better future.
Right. So in other words, by making it impossible for low-income people to move to some of these high-growth areas, it also has an effect that reverberates down to the next generation or multiple generations even.
Yep.
That sucks.
Yeah. Welcome to California.
After the break, we take to the sea.
We go to a port.
And side note, one of the best things about being a reporter is that you can be a grown woman and still ask people to honk their horns for you.
How long do you want it for?
Oh, 5 seconds?
Okay, so 5 seconds on the first one, just...
Is that something that we're not supposed to do anymore when we became adults? I didn't know that.
Support for Planet Money and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to refinancing your existing mortgage or buying a home, Rocket Mortgage lets you understand all the details so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Go to rocketmortgage.com/money.
I'm Scott Detrow. There is so much political news to follow these days, but you don't have to keep up with all of it. You just have to keep up with us on the NPR Politics podcast. You can find us on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
In California, everyone was talking about, and actually still is talking about, this possible trade war between the U.S. and China. Because California is, among other things, home to the biggest ports in the country. The Port of Long Beach and the Port of Los Angeles ship nearly $390 billion worth of goods every year.
So you can see this is the Greater Harbor, the state-of-the-art terminal over here, where you see those cranes moving.
Oh, yeah.
That's the Long Beach Container Terminal.
the Port of Long Beach is this long stretch of coastline in Southern California. There are these giant white and red cranes that hang out over the water and huge ships crawling along the bay. I'm here with Mario Cordero. He's the executive director of the Port of Long Beach. He points out this massive pile of lumber being loaded onto ships bound for Asia. There's a big oil tanker on the horizon and an enormous white ship called the Sea Launch.
It launches a satellite.
That ship launches a satellite?
Launcher.
Oh my gosh.
It goes down to, you know, Ecuador.
And just launches satellites down there?
Right.
Wow. And then they're just like stacks and stacks and stacks and stacks of shipping containers, all different colors over there.
Right. For 2017, we moved upwards of 375 million containers.
And most of these containers are coming from and going to China. Luann Bynum is the president of the Board of Harbor Commission for the Port of Long Beach. She loves the port.
I think it's beautiful. I think it's a piece of art. I mean, everything that everybody has in their homes is touched by the Port of Long Beach in one way or the other.
Is that true?
I think so, yeah. I mean, when
really?
You talk about textiles and electronics and furniture and clothing and, you know, they're all goods that come through the port.
Luann says more than 7 million TEUs come through the Port of Long Beach every year.
What's a TEU?
A total equivalent unit.
What's a total equivalent unit?
So a 20-foot long equivalent unit.
Are those the big
boxes? The boxes that you
And then you just go right onto the back of a truck, right?
Right. Yeah.
A TEU is basically the back of a semi-truck, and the Port of Long Beach moved 7.5 million of them last year.
The stuff in those TEUs is going to retailers like Walmart and Target and Lowe's, and the port facilitates the deals between shipping companies and these retailers. Mario Cordero says that the port business is all about volume. The port makes more money when more ships come in and out. And for the last decade, business has been on a tear.
The economy's been growing, U.S. consumers have been buying more stuff, trade's been expanding, and ships have been getting bigger and bigger to meet this demand. And the Port of Long Beach has been investing billions of dollars to accommodate that growth.
We've invested at the tune of $4 billion over a 10-year period to increase our infrastructure here. We're ready to receive here 20,000 TEU vessels.
20,000 TEU vessels. That is a ship that can hold 20,000 semi-trucks loaded up with stuff. Like the Benjamin Franklin ship, which came through the port last year, it made a big impression on Luann.
It's 20 stories high. That can hold 91 million pair of shoes.
This would be like if you tipped over the Empire State Building and filled it with shoes. Shoes from China. And in fact, 70% of the ships coming to and going from the Port of Long Beach are coming from and going to China. So when the trade war talks started between China and the U.S., Luann and Mario were on high alert.
Do you remember when you heard about the tariffs? Do you remember where you were when you heard that news?
Yes, I was glued to the TV like I've been glued to the TV for the last 18 months.
Luann and Mario were waiting. They were waiting for China and the U.S. to release the lists of things that would be taxed. And when those lists finally came out, they poured over them right away.
And Mario saw lots of foods, like nuts and fruits. He also saw steel and aluminum. And the Port of Long Beach ships all of these things. But Mario says the list was actually kind of a relief because the lion's share of their business was not on the list.
Here at the Port of Long Beach, our largest commodity that is imported is, in fact, furniture. You know, and that's at the tune of 25%.
25% of what comes in here is dressers and couches and beds.
Furniture, which is the reason for the Targets and the Lowe's and, you know, Walmarts. In addition, number two is footwear. So right now, those commodities have not been talked about in terms of the tariff discussion.
Those items aren't on a tariff list right now. But Donald Trump has talked a lot about rethinking free trade and free trade deals. He scrapped the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal, or the TPP, early on in his presidency. And he's talked about throwing out NAFTA. And, of course, there's the trade war talk with China that has been escalating.
And this is happening just as the Port of Long Beach is finishing up its $4.5 billion remodeling to accommodate bigger ships.
I mean, there is a possibility that at least for a little while, for the foreseeable future, free trade is going to move backwards in this country, and the larger ships won't have maybe as much of a future as we thought.
I don't see it going backwards, even in a temporary nature whatsoever.
Really? Because it does seem like maybe we're in a moment, at least politically, that we may be stepping back from free trade. And you know, I mean, if huge tariffs get put in place, there's nothing you can do.
Well, it's 2018, not the 1930s.
That's true. That's really true. You just think things are too interconnected and globalized to go back?
I think that the economy is so integrated and linked anymore.
Gotta admire her optimism.
It's true.
Luann points out that President Trump got a lot of backlash from farmers over the China tariffs, and she also noted some reports that the Trump administration had been reconsidering entering the TPP, though that's all still really uncertain right now. But even so, Luann says they are covering their bases. She and Mario have been exploring trade routes into South America and even Africa, and that's a tiny part of the port's business now, but she says they've got to be ready for anything.
After all, Luann wants to keep ships moving in and out of the port. In fact, she says sometimes she just likes to go out on the pier and watch them.
I mean, to be able to see the terminals and the cranes and the ships moving in and out of the harbor, it's a wonderful appreciation of this economic engine. That's the piece of art. That's the artwork. Look at this. It's beautiful.
We post every episode of Planet Money on Facebook, so if you have thoughts about the show, leave a comment on the post. The Indicator is produced by Darius Rafieyan and edited by Patty Hirsch.
One quick note, we have a new video out this week. It's part of our Planet Money Shorts series. This one is about the rise of the Honeycrisp apple. It's really good. Check it out. And you can find all of our videos at npr.org/planetmoneyshorts.
And lest we forget, listen to The Indicator.
Please.
It comes out every single day. We host it. It's the best.
It is the best.
I'm Cardiff Garcia.
And I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith. Thanks for listening.